Welcome. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting edition of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live right here 5 days a week on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. For those of you who listen live in New Zealand, just bear in mind this is going to be a little bit of an interesting coming week. We have daylight savings, so instead of being 10 a.m. through midday live Tuesday through Saturday, it'll be 11 a.m. through 1 p.m. live Tuesday through Saturday. So hopefully that's not too confusing. And then in a couple of weeks, it gets even more confusing when the U.S. changes their time zones and we become midday through 2 p.m. So changes in there if you're listening live. Fair warning. My very special guest today is Neil Slade. I'm going to picture of him here with a sax. No, it's not a sexual reference. A saxophone, I mean. Neil, welcome to the program.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, man.
All right, great. You're breaking up a little bit, but
oh, really?
Yeah, just a slight...
That can't be good. You can tell what I'm saying, at least, though, eh?
Yes, pretty much.
Okay. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Well, let's see. I am a author. And I've been writing about brain and behavior science for the past, I guess it's 30 years now. And my specialty is this little button, this little magic button inside the brain called the amygdala, and teaching people how to tickle their amygdala and what happens when you do that and what it all means. The amygdala is the little button inside your brain that turns on your fight or flight response. But it's also responsible for reward mechanisms. So it's kind of like it's a compass. It's really a compass that kind of guides you towards those things that increase your survival, and it discourages you from those activities and thoughts and behaviors that inhibits and wrecks your survival.
Okay. Amygdala. It sounds kind of like some sort of Russian warplane.
Yeah, it does. Amygdala. Well, it actually comes from the Greek word meaning nut, it's about the size of the tip of your thumb, and it's located about 1 inch inside each temple. And the kind of nut, I don't mean like Jerry Lewis kind of nut. I mean like a walnut or an almond. And you can the great part about it is you can stimulate it itself, so you can you're not at the mercy of your environment or politicians. You can tickle your amygdala yourself and automatically cause increases in pleasure and creativity and all that good kind of brain stuff.
So it's the it's kind of like a mental masturbation in a way.
I suppose so, yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, it's a little... It does.
Have you ever gone somewhere like real official and stuff like that, made your excuses and just gone into the bathroom for 15 minutes to tickle your amygdala?
You could do it online at the grocery store. That's the beauty of it. And nobody would know except for this big grin on your face. You know, that's the beauty of it. You can do it. You can tickle your amygdala any time and place, you know.
Does it creep people out when they do it in front of them?
No. I mean, it might be just, you know, it might be the indicator might be just a little sly smile on your face. Or it could be a, you know, a gut-wrenching laughter. You might just fall over laughing, you know, after you've just been served a speeding ticket by your local law enforcement officer. So,
oh, yeah.
Although usually you don't think about doing it then, although you could do it then. Well, so it's a beautiful. Go ahead.
Well, is this kind of like a similar release to how I'm kind of using humor and stuff like that to take away the stress and pain of life?
Oh, exactly. And in fact, when you do utilize humor, you know, humor is actually processed in the most advanced part of your brain, in your frontal lobes. And so the amygdala is kind of like a key switch. It's like a little rheostat. So So your brain is your brain has different compartments. So you've got a very advanced part of your brain, which is basically the whole front part of your brain. If you were to grab on your forehead, right, and spread out your fingers, so everything underneath your go ahead, because I'm watching you right here. So if you grab on your forehead with your spread out hand, everything underneath your fingers, that's it. That's your frontal lobes. That's the most advanced part of your brain. Okay. And
Let me see if I can demonstrate. This is my frontal lobe. These are my earlobes.
That's right. Okay. Now on the opposite side of your head, down by the top of your spine, you've got this part of your brain that people fondly call the reptile brain. It's kind of like the top of your, it's the brain stem. It's a very primitive part of your brain. It's what you share with reptiles and snakes, right? So that's a very old part of your brain. But your frontal lobes is a very, evolutionarily speaking, a new part of your brain. It can do all kinds of things that your reptile brain could never even think of doing. Now, right in between your frontal lobes at the front and your reptile brain in the back, you got this little switch, the amygdala, right? And it's like a little toggle switch or like a little rheostat. Not at the top of your head. We're talking about 1 inch. Here, stick your fingers in your ears. Stick your thumbs in your ears, all right? And your thumbs, that's right. Now, take your nasty gesture middle finger and put it in the outside corner of your eye. So move your hand forward and move it down. So that's right. Now your index finger is on your skull, right? Drag it down so your index finger is right in between your thumb and your nasty finger. Just drag it down. Oh, right there. Now point.
Like the temple.
That's right. Point. That's exactly it. Now if you go in 1 inch inside each temple from that point, you hit your amygdala button.
Okay, I'm going to try going in 1 inch from each temple.
Right. So what that amygdala does, it will either allow you to turn on your frontal lobes, or if you are threatened, it'll allow you to turn on your reptile brain and fight and flight, right? So the idea here is that you can self-control the amygdala and keep the good part of your brain, the frontal lobes, turned on, whenever you like or when you need it. And the frontal lobes, as you were talking about a little bit before, is necessary for sense of humor. So whenever you laugh or tell a joke, your frontal lobes are cranking there, right? But if you feel threatened, you see a snake or you get if something bad happens, you click into this reptile brain and you turn on fight or flight and your sense of humor goes out the window. So the idea is the frontal lobes you can solve problems with your frontal lobe rather beyond just fighting or running away, right? That's where all the goody stuff happens. And the beauty of the amygdala is it rewards you with pleasure when you turn on your frontal lobes. So you might as well turn on your frontal lobes and get those goody rewards and turn on all those endorphins and all those feel good brain chemicals. And it's under once you learn how to tickle your amygdala, you can keep those rewards going pretty much whenever you want.
Is it not entirely dissimilar from just rubbing your temples?
It is different from rubbing your temples because it's a much more, rubbing your temples is just kind of like a physical, manipulation. And that's good for you too. There's a guy in Belgium, in Brussels, Belgium, who is a osteopath. And he actually uses physical manipulation to tickle his client's amygdala specifically. So you can use physical manipulation to some extent to tickle this brain organ inside your cranium. But there's a whole slew of ways to tickle your amygdala besides just, rubbing your temple or some other preferred part of your body. So there's. I began to study this brain and amygdala tickling stuff about 30 years ago. There was a guy here in Colorado. And did you mention to your listeners where I'm sitting here on the planet?
I don't know where you're sitting.
Oh, okay. I'm in Denver, Colorado. The highest, I think it's the highest elevation state in the United States. I had met this guy named T.D. Lingo, and he had run a brain and behavior research laboratory back in the 60s and 70s. And his laboratory was was at 10,500 feet. It was in the wilderness. And people would go and spend 6 weeks at his Brain in Nature camp. And they would study brain and behavior science, and they would do, you know, they would do psychotherapy, they would do yoga, they would do meditation, they would study neurophysiology, and they'd learn about the brain. And I spent 11 years with him as his kind of assistant and sidekick. And when he died, I sort of carried on the work of the, as he called it, the Dormant Brain Research and Development Laboratory. So that's kind of my background in all this brain stuff.
And, what was his name again?
His name was, well, he had adopted, his real name was Paul Leschuk. He was of Russian extract, but he changed his name to this kind of Greek, and I couldn't even tell you what it was. So he just used the initials TDA Lingo. And so,
it's almost like he gave himself a rap name.
What kind of name?
A rap name.
A rap name. Yeah, you're right. I never thought about that. You're right. Yeah.
Like Snoop Dogg is, or Dr. Dre. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, exactly. Exactly. Well, yeah.
TD Lingo, fool.
From Laughing Coyote Mountain. He lived on Laughing Coyote Mountain. And he had gone and he'd gotten his PhD in behavior science from the University of Chicago. And he decided he wanted to start his own brain laboratory, but he didn't have any money. So he went into show business because he figured he could make a lot of money fast in show business. And he got himself on Groucho Marx's TV show, You Bet Your Life, back in 1956 or 55. And he made a pile of money. And the executives at NBC television thought he was so funny and clever, they gave him his own summer replacement show in which he played the part of a backwoodsman from the wilds of Colorado. And he had people like Burl Ives and Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger on his show. And he did that for one summer. And then he quit because he made two grocery sacks full of money. So he gave one to the IRS. And the other one, he bought 300 acres of wilderness in Colorado, and that's where he built his log cabins and set up his brain lab. And so for the next 30 years, he did brain science up in the wilderness. And people from all over the world came and studied brain science with him, and I was among the last to go up there, and eventually I kind of took over his work, and that's here I am today talking about brain to a guy from New Zealand.
Yeah, I mean, it's ironic, really, because I haven't accredited much New Zealanders with an overabundance of brains. But the interesting thing that I find is a lot of people, they've got a brain, right? But they don't know how it works. They've got a computer, but they don't know how it works. They've got a heart. But they don't know how it works, and that's the and they got a dog, and they can't get them to shut up. You know, we're walking through life. I feel like ghosts and mist. You know, like nothing upon nothing, and we don't know. We can't see one direction or the other, and most thing. And when people try to tell you, "Hey, look, there's a shape out there, and I can see it's an outline of rocks or something that we're about to crash our ghost ship into," and then everyone's like, "No, don't worry, man, it's gonna be all good."
Everybody's got a brain, but very few people know how it works. So, and once you start looking into how your brain works, it's incredible. It's an infinity machine. It's literally, you know, there are as many connections, possible connections in even the stupidest person that you know of. That person has more connections literally than there are grains of sand on all of the beaches on planet Earth.
And yet they're so stupid that they don't have two brain cells to rub together.
You got it, exactly. So that's why we're here today talking about your brain and what you can do with it, which is pretty much anything you can think of.
Well, quite literally anything you can think of, because if you can think of it, isn't it in your brain?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Is there an outside force, an outside influence on the brain that also governs some of its behaviors and things of that nature? Sure. I was wondering.
How much
overriding influence is there? Because I've got this whole idea that there's a 3D world and I'm currently living in it. You know, if I bash my head against this computer screen, it'll break or my head will. But I'm not going to fool myself into thinking that I'm at some kind of mystical point of manifestation where I can just pass through it and the molecules will simply allow me to, sort of thing, right? And yeah. Is it a question of belief? I mean, maybe some ascended masters and stuff like that have been able to do this, but so many people nowadays believe that it's like they feel that the understanding of brain and some of the physical realities and matter of the universe and knowledge of aliens and etc. Kind of makes the 3D world no longer exist, like they think that they're going to turn into astral traveling creatures, traveling the stars at ad infinitum and be able to experience everything that could ever be. I'm just thinking about it. Anybody who's ever hyped up a doomsday just wound up losing all their wealth to the person who sold it to them. We'll be right back.
There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting on AmericanFreedomRadio.com from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island-chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific.
Hey, if it's
fluoridated and what's up?
What are you doing in New Zealand if this is American Freedom Radio? That's my question.
Well, have you ever heard of the tall poppy syndrome?
No.
No.
Explain that to me, please.
You ever seen people in your country who will see others who have worked real hard and have original ideas who get henpecked by all the morons around them and they have to leave the country in order to make their fortune?
Well, I don't know too many have left the country, but otherwise I can relate exactly to what you're saying, yes.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
in New Zealand, it's a bit more pronounced. If you stand out, if you're different and things like that, it's kind of like a small town pretending to be a country, as my producer would say. So you have that sort of small town mentality of, I don't know, stick your head down, get in line. Very similar to the whole rest of the New World Order system. And basically, I found it doesn't really matter where you are or what you go. You just need somebody to give you a shot. And as it turns out, people who are in the United States in American Freedom Radio who are entrepreneurial, incredibly good at spotting freaking spectacular talent, and I'm talking about the other show hosts here, not just myself. Of course, I am referring to myself in this instance. Give me a shot, and suddenly, boom! I'm the first New Zealander to have a radio show in America. And the interesting thing about it is, I know more about America than most Americans do.
That scares
the hell out of them.
That's a scary thought right there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and it's not that I'm real smart. It's that the American people have been so dumbed down.
Oh, dare I agree with you. Yes, I know what you're speaking. Well, you know, the human brain. Oh, there goes my phone here. Julia Liu, please take this phone out of the room. That's my lovely wife, artist Julia Liu, and now removing that annoying ringing phone. But we have this saying around here that the human brain is 90% dormant, and it could be very well that most 90% of the people out there have a 90% dormant brain. But in actuality, everyone has a 90% dormant brain. If the human brain has infinite potential, then any percent of infinity is an infinitely small portion, is it not?
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Right. Yeah. You will never know how much your brain is capable of, because it is capable of infinity. Mm. And on that note,
I was thinking of infinity. Have you ever done Yum Cha? Chinese restaurants, and they bring around all these little bowls of food and stuff like that. And it's not like you sit in there and ordering.
We call it dim sum.
Dim sum, and we call it Yum Cha. You know, it's same diff, right?
Yeah.
I was thinking that's kind of how the conspiracy realm works. You know, Jerusalem, all this stuff's like whizzing past you, and it's got all these different sights and smells and flavors, and they look weird and strange, and you're like, oh, I'll try a little bit of that. I'll try a little bit of that. And before you know it, you've eaten poison fugu and you've gone nuts.
Yep. Well, let me tell you a little bit about tickling your amygdala. This is the ability to self-stimulate this magic little button inside your brain. And the beauty of it is nature has provided us with this very handy little compass that tells you when you are going in the right direction, and it tells you when you're going in the wrong direction. So the amygdala is, imagine if you had a little compass, right? And you look down at it, and it's pointing north, right? And you want to head towards the South Pole. So you use a compass and you kind of can realign yourself and you know what direction to go. Well, the brain does this with emotions. And so this amygdala sits right smack in the middle of this kind of emotional circuitry in your brain. So you automatically get rewards, emotional rewards, when you're headed in the direction of self-survival. And we call that an amygdala tickle. When you're going in the right direction, you get this emotional tickle, okay? But conversely, when you're going in the wrong direction, you get what's called an amygdala bite. So I'm sure you can relate to that. When you sort of had a feeling that you were doing the wrong thing, right?
Yesterday, this dude called me up on the phone and he says he wants to, that he knows the stuff that'll blow my mind and blah, 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 blah. And he wants to do an interview, kind of forceful and sort of disrespectful in a way, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I was just like, okay, well, how do you want to do the interview? You want to do phone? You want to do it over Skype? And he's like, I want to eyeball you, you know, I want to be around at your house. So I gave him my address. And as I was giving him my address, I was just like feeling this blowing, maybe I'm not doing the right thing here. I guess we'll find out.
Yeah. Oh, well, your amygdala was kind of nipping at your, taking a little chunk there.
Is it?
Yeah.
And that's another thing. If it's a brain mechanism, does it mean it can be wrong with its intuition?
Here's the thing. Okay, so it's the amygdala sits in between the most advanced part of your brain, the frontal lobes, and the more primitive part of your brain, the reptile brain, right?
So it's a bridge.
Yeah, it's kind of a bridge. It's more like a light switch. Okay, so for example, the electricity is coming into your house from the utility company, right? And it goes to your light switch, right? And now you can flick that light switch up, and that'll send the electricity all the way up to the ceiling light, okay? And then you can light up the room and see what you're doing. So there's energy from outside, and then it comes to this little switch, and you can either send, you know, you can send the energy wherever you want. Maybe you want to turn on an electric fan, or you want to turn on your computer. And it's kind of like a rheostat because it's got multiple positions. It's not just on or off. It could be, you know, you can send it over here, you can send it over there, and whatever. But the thing to remember with the amygdala is, again, you've got this advanced part of your brain which understands the big picture, right? Your frontal lobes I have an acronym called CICIL, C-I-C-I-L. So the frontal lobes computes creativity, imagination, cooperation, intuition, logic, all these kind of higher functions of the brain. It can calculate.
So no relations to the Cecil Rhodes Scholarship or anything?
No. Beanie and Cecil. That's what I like to think of. Beanie and Cecil. I mean, you're probably too young to remember the cartoon Beanie and Cecil. Anyway, but so your frontal lobes can calculate cause and effect. It can see the big picture. It's okay. It can see how all different kinds of things are connected. It can understand concepts of time. Okay. Your reptile brain, on the other hand, is only stuck in the here and now. It doesn't see the big picture. It only can calculate what's 2 inches in front of your nose, right? Okay, so the amygdala is giving you feedback. It says, this feels good, right? Okay, well, if all you are doing is looking at your amygdala with your reptile brain and stuck in the here and now, you may do something that feels good right for this moment, but a week from now, you may have a reality hangover, right? You may do something. Okay, you've got a keg of beer, and your reptile brain says, "Hey, you know what? I'm going to drink this keg of beer because it feels good right now." And you keep indulging, but the next morning you wake up with this reality hangover. So the reptile brain can only decipher what the amygdala is telling you just for one moment. But if you look at what the amygdala is saying with your frontal lobes, the frontal lobes can predict what's going to happen a week from now. And the frontal lobes can say, hey, if I do this today, it's going to feel good today and it's going to feel good tomorrow. Or the frontal lobes can say, oh, it may feel good today, but it's going to feel like crap 2 weeks from now. Or, you know, hey, this girl looks mighty tempting to be hanging out with, right? That's what the reptile brain is saying. But the frontal lobes is saying, hold your horses, buddy. You need to consider long term. You need to add this little piece to the puzzle and this little piece. So the amygdala, this compass, the compass is pretty accurate. But you want to know what that compass is going to say, not only today, but what the compass is going to say tomorrow and 2 weeks down the road and a month down the road. And your frontal lobes can figure out what your amygdala is going to say long term. So you got to look at it. You got to look at the amygdala just not for today, but over the long term. And if you can do that, then you'll get accurate readings. You know, the frontal lobes will allow you to turn on all these kind of paranormal types of facilities that you have in your brain, you know, like intuition, ESP, clairvoyance, clairaudience. These are real skills. And these will also help you to kind of understand, you know, what this amygdala compass is telling you over the long term. So you can get bad information from the amygdala if you're just looking at it, you know, if you're only looking at what's 2 inches in front of your nose. You always got to calculate the big picture. And if you do that, your amygdala will become your best friend. Does that kind of answer your question there? It's kind of complicated, but not really so.
Well, I see this puzzled look on your face. Look at it this way. It's kind of like, how would I describe it? I pride myself on being really good at analogies, but you'll have to excuse me. I'm getting up at like 2:30 this morning to be on the Jack Blood Show, and the archives are now up, ladies and gentlemen. So you can go and copy those and download them if you want, but how could you frame this? It's sort of like a cross between a drug that gives you deep insight as well as a clitoris.
Yeah, right. I think you're right. I think that's a good analogy. You know, the information is here. Here's a better way of looking at it. Or not better, but here's another way. Information is only as good as the person who's looking at the information. Okay, so there goes Chloe again. So your amygdala is giving you some feedback. It's giving you it's an emotional feedback system. It's saying, hey, this is good for you. Hey, Brian, would you shut Chloe up? Thanks.
Sounds like she wants some emotional feedback.
She barks at any flea that walks past our window in the front here. But anyway, Okay, so information is only as good as that person who's looking at the information, okay? It's giving you, you know, information is dependent. It's quantum physics. This is what quantum physics has told us, that the information that you get is modified by the observer, right? Or here's a question. Is a knife a weapon or a tool? Well, it depends if you're a surgeon or if you're a mugger, right? So the information itself is neither positive or negative. It's how you kind of look at it. So,
all right, you've got so this government looks at that, goes, let's outlaw knives so people can't eat and can't stab people.
You got it. So you've got this reptile part of your brain, and it's basically a very limited, it has very limited abilities. It's very primitive, right? Your reptile brain is no smarter than, you know, a turtle walking down the sidewalk, right? Okay, so if you're looking at your amygdala with nothing but your reptile brain, you're going to be limited in understanding what your amygdala is telling you. You're going to be
you're kind of reptarded.
That's right. You're very good. I like that. But on the other hand, if you look at the amygdala with your frontal lobes, with this very smart part of your brain that calculates concepts of time and sees the big picture, then you're going to get a much better understanding of what this amygdala is trying to tell you. You'll take into account the information that your amygdala is telling you at the moment, but you'll also kind of look at it in a big time frame, and you'll look at it as part of a bigger picture. And and so that kind of is how I address that question of, can your amygdala be wrong? You know, it's just, how are you looking at your amygdala?
Are you healthy? Are you bright? Are you capable of ascertaining other information while not relying sheerly on gut instinct? Like if your gut instinct is telling you, just jump off the cliff, mate, you'll be fine. The rest of you has to bring into account and just go, let's just chuck a wee rock off this cliff just to be sure. Yep. There ain't nothing there to break my fall. I'm not going to jump off it.
Well, the trick is to really know what your brain is capable of, right? You know, most people tend to get stuck in one frame of mind or another. So part of my job is to point out to people, hey, listen, your brain can do this and your brain can do this. Here's the whole big tool chest of your brain, you know, instead of being just...
We're coming to break
now. Okay.
So... we'll come back and we'll talk about the tool chest of the brain on the BinnieEastwoodShow.com. Jingle, jingle. We'll be right back.
Ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor. Smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor. Believe what you want, but my evidence is greater. What you know about the Bilderberg and New World Order? What you know about the real fluoride in your water? What you know about the breed of uranium in the mortar? What you know about AIPAC controlling the reporter? What's wrong with the world? People kill people that other people command. Middle East is a modern day attack on the native land. Project eugenics planned on the common man. Expand the military industrial complex. Annex or install you with chemical objects. Vex the psyop.
Yeah, welcome back to the show that's all about the PSYOP attacking your conscience. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnyEastwoodShow.com. And I love the idea of people going to the website and going through that archive section and seeing just the huge quantity of different guests and different topics that are on there. Trust me, listen to them all. And I encourage people, if you're listening to one show here or there or whatever, you don't get the full picture, man. You really got to be listening every day. And you'll be like me. You become smarter day by day by interviewing people and listening to people that are smarter than you in many ways every day. Or at least that's my philosophy anyway. Like Neil Slade, for instance. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi again. Yeah. I think you're right. Variety is not only the spice of life, but it's the spice of your brain. And this past year, I wrote this new book, which I called Tickle Your Amygdala. And the idea in this book was to talk to a lot of different people who have all who do all different kinds of things. I think we get into trouble when we have a mono diet, whether it's intellectual or whatever it is. And so I know a lot of people around the world, and I talk to some scientists, I talk to some comedians, I talk to two dogs, as you can hear. And let me rattle off a couple of the people that are, that I talked to this year, because some of these people are just astonishing. Of course, I mentioned to you when we were off the air, I had a nice conversation with Terry Jones, who was one of the founding members of Monty Python's Flying Circus. And I wanted to find out how he tickled his amygdala. And so we talked about that. Josh Blue is actually a neighbor of mine, and he won this NBC television show called Last Comic Standing. And was a very interesting person to talk to about brain. There's a guy named Dr. Lawrence Blair from your part of the world. And Lawrence and his brother spent a couple decades sailing around Indonesia and going into Borneo and Bali. And one of the, if you go to the Tickle Your Amygdala webpage on my site, which incidentally you can find at brainradar.com, there's a picture of Dr. Blair visiting with this fellow named John Chang. And John Chang is an astonishing human being who can make electricity with his hands. He can light up a light bulb by holding the light bulb in his hands. There is video on my site of him setting crumpled up newspaper on fire with his hands. And this all is a matter of how John Chang tickles his amygdala and works his brain power. So he's very interesting. I talked with a woman.
It sounds very similar to the gift one of the X-Men had on the new ones. Was it X-Men Wolverine's origins? And they were part of this kind of the special mutant team. And one of the guys had that gift to make electricity work, not by touch, but with his mind. He was actually able to make things work without even touching them, by just thinking about it.
Oh yeah, John Chang does. Go to my website. You'll see him move. I don't remember if it's chopsticks or. Oh, I know what it is. He had one of these things. It's like a dagger. There's a name for it in Chris. It's called a Chris. It's a ceremonial dagger, and he's focusing on this with his brain power. Right, he's focusing on it with his brain radar. Brain, and you see this Chris turn on the table, just from focusing his brain's energy on it. And it's not a trick. I mean, I know Lawrence Blair, and he is a very stand-up, serious anthropologist. And, and this guy, John Chang, they had some scientists examine this guy. They made him strip down to his underwear. They went over him with a metal detector to make sure he didn't have some electronic devices implanted under his skin. And they're sitting there measuring the voltage that's coming out of his fingertips. And unlike Wolverine or these guys in X-Men, this is a real guy who is, who has this ability to do this kind of thing. And we all have these kinds of abilities, not necessarily to the extent of a John Chang, but what I illustrate in my writing is that, you and me and your next door neighbor, we do have this kind of infinite reservoir of ability that's inside our brain. If we can just learn how to tap into it, it's the race is on. There's all kinds of amazing things that we'll witness and we'll experience.
Mm-hmm. And you understand how many other people don't experience this. Like one of the listeners popped in the chat room, and I think it's quite apt basically cut off people are. Oh, we got both kinds of music. We got country and Western.
Yeah, that's right. So, that, and like I said earlier on, that's why I talk to all these different kinds of people. And that's why I wanted to, you know, see, you know, well, this person maybe activates their infinite brain energy by meditation. But it doesn't mean that you have to meditate, because Josh Blue turns on his brain energy by telling jokes, you know, or this other woman uses acupuncture, or this other guy listens to music. Or I talked to Michelle McCoskey, and she was in on the she's in the book. She was responsible for the very first software put into the very first Apple and IBM computers. And she tickles her amygdala. And so we talked about, you know, how she did it and what kinds of things that she did to tap into this. So it's a matter of, you know, get information from as many different sources as you can. Just don't be on a mono diet. Just like you were telling people after the break, we've got all these radio shows. Don't just listen to the one show. Listen to the whole smorgasbord. And that's where your brain power comes from, you know, from expanding your mind, not by putting blinders on.
Yeah, so it's funny. I just had a thought yesterday. Maybe I should group all these things up. And when I put out the messages onto different people's Facebook groups and things like that, maybe I'll just restrict what I put up there, and I'll only put, like, let's say I'll have a group for people who are only interested in financial stuff, a group for people who are only interested in UFO stuff, and just kind of pick and mix and just try to appeal to those when it suits them. And now I'm thinking, not. Everybody needs to be exposed to everything kind of thing. Otherwise, you never become familiar or immune with enough.
I like when you put two things together that you normally wouldn't associate together. And Frank Zappa he's a guy that's in my book, and I met and talked with Frank many years ago while he was still alive. But that was kind of how he approached his music. He said, you know what? What if I put a country tune with music that sounds like Igor Stravinsky? Then what do I get? You know? And he endlessly came up with all kinds of very interesting kinds of things, because he wasn't afraid of putting elements together that normally you wouldn't associate. So that was why this book was so much fun, because I might talk with a CPA one day and I might talk with a painter the next day, and everybody kind of contributes. They give a very well-rounded picture about what brain self-control is all about. It's not just about sitting in a lotus position going om, you know, that will work, but there's an infinite number of other ways to stimulate your brain and to tap into this incredible infinity machine that you've got sitting right between your ears. You have the most powerful computer in the universe right now sitting between your ears, you know. Use it. It's a blast.
Yeah. And you notice so many people, they use computers every day, but they don't know how to program one. They don't know how to take one apart and put it back together. And I was alluding to this earlier, and I still want to kind of allude to it further. We don't know who we are. We don't know what we're capable of. We don't know anything. The second you think you've got everything figured out, that's the moment when you learn something different.
Yes.
Every single time, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, that was, you know, up at the brain lab, that was kind of like, there would be like three questions. And I don't know if I can remember all three, but every participant at the brain lab would be given, you'd start a notebook, a self kind of analysis notebook, and you'd have to answer the question, who am I? Where am I going? And I can't think of the third question at this moment, because it's been a while. But yeah, that's the rudimentary question. Who am I? That's a question that few people even bother to ask. But, you know, it's a question that needs to be asked, I think.
Yeah, well, I think it's real interesting. They try to find solutions out there, when the solutions are usually just inside, right in front of your face. You know, you travel the world to find a culture you like, and then you return home to think, why did I leave? I was so comfortable, and I had to go out and learn all this other stuff and have all these other experiences in order to appreciate what I already had. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Neil Slade, and we will be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Alert the masses! Gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the reason why it's the fastest 2 hours in talk radio is because by the end of it, you wonder where the heck it went. And as the old saying goes, time flies when you're having fun. And that's the only rule on this show. Have fun. That's why we don't, you know, get into arguments with the guests, critique them about stuff. And be otherwise mean to them. What do you gain by that? You really only gain ground with good people by doing good things. Why spend your time doing the opposite? I don't get it. Some people have got this, rift between what they want and what they're doing, and they try to close that rift with hate. Got to close it with love, man. Got to close it with openness, ironically. Neil Slade. Okay. sorry, ladies and gentlemen. Like I said, that's up at 2:30 right. This morning. Not with it!
I wrote a book called Have Fun, incidentally, Vincent. Now that you mentioned that, Have Fun, Anti-Rules. Anti-Rules.
This reminds me of another good thought that I had last night. If you notice any of the best thoughts in the middle of the morning, you create a network that's called the Freedom Underground Network, otherwise the Fun Network.
Oh yeah,
for all this type of commentary and all of that kind of stuff. But of course, making sure you're just having fun.
Have fun.
Yeah,
absolutely. Your brain will reward you with fun when you're going the right direction. Why make yourself miserable? Right?
Yeah. It's like fighting against the current. You know, your brain and your body and everything, they tell you to have fun. They tell you to enjoy yourself. But we ignore it and say, no. I have to subject myself to servitude and I have to work really hard so that my boss can get rich and the rest of my money can be taken away from taxation. Okay, that's the honorable thing to do.
Well, that's nature is miraculously intelligent because they've set up your brain so that when you are doing something that's good for you, as a general rule, you feel good about doing it. And if you're doing something that's not good for you, the brain and nature discourages you from going down that road by giving you pain, right? That whole saying of no gain without pain, it's a bunch of baloney. There are some things when you look at the big picture that you say, well, you know what, I gotta do these 10 sit-ups, you know, and even though momentarily it's work, I'll feel good about it in the long run. And that's the genius of nature. Your brain rewards you with pleasure and good feelings when you're doing something that's good for you. And it tells you through pain and negative emotion when you're doing something that's not good for you. And that's a good general rule. There are a few little exceptions, but if you use your frontal lobes, you'll be able to detect, you know, those instances. Well, where you say, well, you know what? At this point in time, I gotta, you know, I gotta do these sit ups, or put off instant reward for the moment, because in the long run, I'm going to feel much better for doing this thing. So nature's pretty smart in that way. I wanted to read you this one quote. There's a guy named Robert Schneider who lives in Cambodia. And I had interviewed him for this book. And he had contacted me years ago. He had been working in this yacht factory in, I think it was Pennsylvania at the time. And he was having a miserable time. And he told me, he says, people would do stuff at this boat building factory. Like, if someone did something that you didn't like, you would like staple his hand to the side of a boat. Right? It was very, very kind of difficult environment. Lots of toxic chemical fumes. The place was freezing. And he had been practicing this kind of amygdala tickling exercise where you just kind of imagine a feather inside your head. And you just kind of, you locate your amygdala and you imagine a feather, right? And then you just tickle on one amygdala. You've got two amygdala in your brain, right? You've got one on the right side and one on the left side. So the exercise is where you just imagine a feather and you tickle your amygdala. And he was doing it. And one day it all clicked. And so he told me, and I'll just read this little quote. So Robert says, but anyway, one day I was driving along thoroughly depressed, and I did a little amygdala click and became completely blissed out. That's what he said. And I laughed when he told me this. And I said, you weren't taking any drugs, correct? And he says, no drugs whatsoever. But it was as if I had taken a very strong one. It was that big a change. That feeling persisted for a good 6 or 8 months, I guess. A permanent high. Every time I tickled forward, I'd get on a big high. It was simply that flip, that simple little flip of the amygdala. This is what is so extraordinary to me, that it happened and that there wasn't anything subtle about it. It was just a complete change of outlook. So what he's telling us in this statement is that he was able to access these very, very powerful chemicals that your brain manufactures. And it's a fact. Your brain makes these chemicals that are like 100 times more powerful than heroin. Literally. They're called endorphins and enkephalins. And if you can figure out how to kind of flip that little switch to increase those naturally occurring painkillers and euphoric chemicals in your brain, I mean, it's very empowering. You no longer are at the mercy of your boss or the environment or whoever won the last election, or you're no longer at the mercy of having a million. You don't need $1 million in the bank anymore because you've got access to your own brain and these extremely powerful chemicals. And he would, in particular, he was in a very negative situation. He had just, you know, he was at a job that he hated. His wife had just divorced him. His father had just died. And yet he was able to tickle this little switch in his brain. And he's not an insane guy. I mean, you know, he had just kind of figured out, okay, what do I have to do to flip this little switch? And for him, it was this humongous transformation. And, you know, it's in everybody's brain. Everybody can kind of, you know, everyone has access and to that ability to kind of flip things around like that. You just got to know where the switch is and what flips it.
It's kind of like knowing your triggers if you've got an anger problem.
Yeah, exactly. And again, you know, I mean, and what I tried recently this past year was trying to figure out, well, okay, I know how I tickle my amygdala, but that's not necessarily how you're going to do it. Everybody's an individual, everybody's brain circuitry is a little bit different. And like you said, you know, answer that question, who am I? So you figure out who you are, and you figure out what tickles your amygdala, and you do that. And then maybe you look at how somebody else is doing it, and you add that onto your menu. You say, well, okay, I turn on my brain. I know this works. But, you know, if that doesn't work one day, what are my options? And so you kind of you open yourself up to all these different methods, you know, by which you can access all this infinity brain power inside your brain. And I think that's the real secret, is if there is a secret, is just, you know, not put any limitations on yourself and get information and see how other people are doing it.
Mm. Well, since somebody told me the other day that there is no secret, it hasn't been a secret ever.
No.
Even the book, The Secret, is revealing something that ain't a secret, you know. And the whole idea of a secret is it's deliberately being kept from everybody, and you can't access it for want of money or power or anything like that.
No, I agree with you.
Whereas this doesn't qualify. This is something that's always been there. It's more of a forgotten memory than a secret.
Oh, I agree with you. You know, that book in particular kind of irks me, because I think that book really emphasizes the accumulation of material stuff, or maybe it's status, or it's saying, oh, okay, if you imagine getting something, you'll get it. And I think that's going down the wrong path.
If I may, if you need something, you'll get it. That's a better mentality, because I want a whole lot of things, Neil, you know, to help me with this radio show. But there's not only a few things that I need, like, you know, food, power, water, bread, you know, that kind of stuff. Having my car fixed so I can go to protests, et cetera. And I've found, since doing this radio show thing, all of those things that I need turn up for me. All of those things that I want, I have to work 10 times harder than I currently am in order to earn them.
Well, I tend to agree with you. I think, you know, what you really need is far less than what we desire or what we want. And for me, I think that book, The Secret, really shifts people away from that, instead of, allowing people to focus on what is internal inside your head. It's saying, well, oh, if you have $1 million, just imagine you have $1 million and then it'll come your way. Or, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with accumulating some things or accomplishing goals. But I think the focus should really be on how you feel inside, and how, you know, what's going on in between your two ears, what's going on between your behind your eyes. And if you can focus on that, I think you're going to answer a lot more questions, and ultimately you're going to be a whole lot more satisfied with whatever you just happen to have, rather than be focused on the accumulation of status or material goods or money or whatever. And I think that's the great mistake of that book, The Secret. Besides, I agree with you. I don't think there are any secrets out there.
What's funny is I was speaking to James Wright, who's a kind of paid member of the Supreme Council of the Scottish Rite, 33rd degree kind of thing. And one of the things that come out in the conversations with him and say Freder X as well, and other Freemasons, is that although it's a secret society, if you come up and ask the right questions, they will tell you the answers. You have to ask the questions in a very, very specific way that's already been outlaid, though.
Now, what is this society called?
The secret society known as the Freemasons.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, the world's largest secret society, 1 million members, and 100 members who are 33rd degree, which are the highest of the Scottish Rite, which isn't Freemasonry at all. It's just kind of like a parasite on what Freemasonry used to be about self-expansion, and instead it's just turned it all into dark occulted mysticism and attempting to provoke demon worshipping and the governing of immoral men over the minds of others.
Well, allow me to ask you a question, if I may. So mm-hmm. So we've been talking about, you know, brain feedback, and I think you've got a kind of basic understanding of what this amygdala organ does. You know, how it's this feed. If you were to tell someone how you tickle your amygdala, what would you tell them? How do you tickle your amygdala? How do you turn on that positive emotional feedback? You know, what turns it on for you?
It's randomness. My brain works in a really weird way, but it works. And you hang out with me for long enough, it doesn't matter what you're doing with me, whether you're talking about deep philosophy, technology, or just shooting the breeze and having a few drinks. Almost every second sentence or whatever, things will be said that I will turn into a joke of some kind. So you have this, like the amygdala is a permanent, and the brain, a permanent, infinite something generator. I've become to embody that I myself am an infinite cackle generator. Capable of generating cackles far beyond my means, and on a rather consistent basis. And I think it's because I'm so silly. You know, I take everything and think about things very, very seriously, yet I'm aware of it, but I've shed my fear of it, if that makes any sense. And that's how I tickle my amygdala, is I make fun of all these things that terrify me.
So it sounds like you really like to tap into this humorous perspective, and at the same time you like the surprise, the non-predictability, and it sounds like the reward from you comes from this kind of improvisation, right? And riding by the seat of your pants. And
well, my brother is a surfer, right?
Yeah.
And the way I've just described myself with humor, and the way you kind of put it as sort of riding it as it were, is the exact same sensation he feels when he goes surfing. You're in the zone and you're being carried, and there's something pushing you that's renewable, like waves. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I'm talking about. All right, well, we're coming up to break now. We'll be right back in just a few minutes, ladies and gentlemen, with the rather stimulating, in the amygdala sense of the word, Neil Slade.
The way it's going to be.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humor, you'll go friggin' nuts. And as far as I know, there ain't anybody else in Patriot Talk Radio who takes everything quite as seriously as I do. And by that I mean they take it more seriously than I do, which kind of increases the effect of the seriousness of the information ad infinitum, which can bring it all down on you, okay?
if I was to tell you a few things, like the military is just, or the police have just ordered like umpteen bazillion rounds of hollow point ammunition, and tell you that the only reason why that's going to happen is because they're going to shoot them into crowds so that they stop, and they're designed to kill, and that there's FEMA camps everywhere, and there's these massive coffins, and that there's a vaccination program, and there's PDD 51 that says the president is a dictator, and that they're surveilling in everything that you do, and there's predator drones that are honed in on your nutsack. All these really terrible, scary things that you could be worried about. But I can assure you that these things aren't killing you right now, just yet. They ain't in your face. But you've got to be aware of them, but figure out a mental faculty, because when you're perceiving a threat, it's a mental faculty thing, okay? If a threat ain't actually real, if there ain't a real lion in front of you about to devour your frickin' arm, then there's no reason to be, like, terribly, deathly afraid, per se. You've got to come up with coping mechanisms. Like a rape victim, for instance, after the event, there is such trauma, such terrifying destruction of the internal part of that person. And this happens whether it's a male or female rape victims, both. The shame and the self-pity and things like that happen to us. This can be happening to us through purely psychological means as well. And people need to recognize these, that they are just as powerful, well, actually nowhere near as powerful, but still a similar effect, as being physically violated in such a way. You're being psychologically violated by terrifying information. Right. Neil Slade is my guest.
No, you reminded me of a couple of things. So the first thing, when you said FEMA, it reminded me of a funny story. I forget the guy's name. He's kind of like one of these sensationalist doomsayers. And he had done a video that was going around on the internet, and he was talking about FEMA camps, internment camps that they had set up in Denver for the Democratic convention. And he had discovered this camp, and he took the camera crew, and they were going in through the back gate of this FEMA camp where they had these barracks set up where they were going to put all of these people after the government takeover. And I'm looking at him, I go, wait a minute, I know that place. Yeah, that's where I used to pick up hamburger and hot dog buns to deliver to the Denver Public Schools when I used to drive a delivery truck, and anybody could walk into this place, and it just completely fabricated this thing. And all it was this big warehouse across the street from the Coca-Cola bottling company. And everybody, you know, and he just kind of manufactured this whole kind of scare thing. And it was just in people's imagination, and there was no basis for it whatsoever. He had just found this one, you know, a place that had some fencing around it and all that kind of thing. But it also, what you were just talking about also reminded me about the studies at Harvard, and we, you know, talking about brain self-control and so on and so forth. When I tell people that when you do these kind of amygdala tickling mental exercises, when like you imagine a feather inside your head, how it changes your brain chemistry. There's a woman who ran a series of experiments at the Harvard Medical School from about, I think it must have been 1997 through 2009, for a long period of time. And what they found was that just a mental picture, it might be something as simple as repeating a phrase inside your own head, would dramatically change your brain chemistry, and they could track it on these brain scanning devices. So when people think, well, if I just think something, it's just a thought, it's not going to change how my brain operates. But what this woman and her team of scientists showed is just a very simple thought can have profound effects on your brain chemistry, and then as well on the way that the rest of your body responds to things. So something's just as simple as imagining a feather inside your head can have profound effects on how your brain works. And they can show you on a brain scanning device, you know, that this is actually happening.
Yeah, I mean, the stimulation of the brain is kind of like a, there's no filter. You receive everything equally. So if I was to show you a picture of an incredibly sexy naked woman right now, you would instantly have a reaction whether or not you chose to act on it or anything like that. That brain reaction is instantly there. And this is how brainwashing through the media works to the extent possible.
Yes. Oh, I think these days especially, this is used by people in power and in politics. They know how the brain operates. And so they tap into these primitive processes within the brain, and they can manipulate people. The defense that you have is that you can understand how your brain works. You can know a little bit about what fight or flight is in the brain. You can know how one part of the brain processes information as opposed to another part. And in that way, knowledge for you is power. So you can you have a defense against this subliminal and unconscious manipulation of people who would have you go buy a case of candy bars when you maybe wouldn't want to otherwise, or vote for someone who otherwise you wouldn't vote for.
Well, and the question is, who do you vote for amidst a it's like when you're living in a collectivist society, it means that your choices become irrelevant because the collective overrides your individuality and your ability to choose for yourself. And that's what voting has become, as far as I'm concerned, is a madness in a lot of ways that's infected people because they perceive that who they're voting for and what they stand for and what they're talking about aren't lies. They actually think that they're telling the truth.
Yes, yes.
And this is the funny thing about it, because if you're basing your entire life, your country and your future on somebody that is lying to you so obviously, it becomes so inevitable, shall we say, that the country will fall. And so and you with it, because you've tied yourself into the collective and the collective is going down, so must you be.
You must think independently. You've seen George Carlin and his brilliant, just absolutely brilliant observations about the whole political process. And, something for everyone to watch, to understand how they may be, missing the bigger picture and how they get caught up in the, in the propaganda and the manipulation that goes on. And so it's doubly important these days to understand, you know, how perception works and how your brain works and that sort of thing.
This reminds me of something Bill Cooper said, that people who are easily led around like that, like the people we've been discussing, are dangerous. Very dangerous. They can be whipped up by any wily demagogue who can dangle a wee carrot or piece of meat in front of their face and lead them around. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think it's very important to be able to, if there's one thing that I think is important for people to understand about the human brain, is the ability for people to understand the difference between this reptilian reactive part of their brain and the reflective part of the brain. And Richard Restek has really simplified understanding the brain by saying, okay, the human brain you can divide in half. You've got a reactive half, which is primarily the back half of your brain. It's lower and it's towards the back of your cranium. And then you've got this reflective part of your brain, which tends to be higher and towards the front. And we get into trouble when we react, simply react. there are times when it's important to react. You're crossing the street and all of a sudden you see an 18-wheeler coming towards you. Well, you want to react. It's not like the reactive part of your brain is bad for you, but you don't want to be controlled purely by this reactive part of our brain. But yet, if we turn on television often, if we go to the movies, if we just watch people's behavior in general, we see a lot of reactive behavior in which the reflective part of the brain, the part of the brain that understands things at a much deeper level, that tries to weigh this against that sees the whole picture as opposed to just what's 2 inches in front of your nose. If we can engage more and more of this reflective part of our brain, we're going to be so much better off. And yet,
It's about, I presume you've met people who are reactionary, who have, out of nothing, blow up at you like a nuke in your face.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And have a discussion with this about the parts of the brain, and that's a reptilian brain response. It's the fight or flight mechanism right down the bottom of your cortex, your very, very base instincts. You know, there's your sex in there, there's your pleasure in there, there's your survival instincts, etc. And here's how you tell whether or not you're having a thinking response or a reptilian reactionary fight or flight response. Had you stopped before opening your big mouth, counted to 10, and thought for a moment, would you have said the exact same thing to them anyway?
Yeah, very good, very good. Count to 10. I love it.
Okay. Yeah, and it's about restraint. And I find any power needs restraint. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about a power plant where the fires that are heating the water and producing the steam and what have you need to be contained so they don't burn all the workers around in the factory. Also, your mind and your reactions and your emotions have much power and a great sway over others. And that, too, you have to restrain yourself. And that's what kind of personal responsibility is really about. If you had everybody on a beach that was a trained lifeguard, would you still need a lifeguard on watch?
Probably not.
Probably not, because everybody knows how to take care of themselves. And I was just thinking this. If everybody was fiscally responsible, mentally and emotionally responsible, we would lose the need and the necessity that the bankers tell us that we need, you know, of massive financial institutions, pharmacopoeic drugs, etc. We would lose the need for those because we have the power to do those positions and those expertise ourselves. If only we would believe that we're capable of it and actually try. The problem I found is most people stop themselves from being brilliant before they even try.
I've been dealing with the city of Denver this past month over a traffic ticket. I'll have to admit, I was given unfairly a traffic ticket in which the speed limit signs were actually literally hidden from view, right? They had speed limit signs, but they were behind the work trucks, right? And the cops had set up the speed trap. So they knew the signs were sitting on the ground and they were hidden, and that was the scam, right? So I've had to deal with a number of government agencies, and what had been made clear to me over and over again was the shirking of responsibility. It was extremely rare that I had someone who would say to me, well, you know what, I think we ought to do this, and let me help you do this, or would make a decision or take some responsibility so that we could move this, do the right thing in this particular case. And in talking with other people also who had been victimized at one point or another by an unfair traffic citation, I again would note over and over again where people didn't want to take responsibility. They said, well, you know, there's nothing I can do about it, or I don't have time to do this or whatever. And your point about If everyone on the beach was a lifeguard, it's such a great point, because this is how we need to live, where we each take responsibility for our own actions instead of depending upon someone else. And
at the same point, lifeguards have teammates. So if everybody was on the lifeguard on the beach, you'd take care of each other when anybody would ask for help. Here we go. We're coming back in just a few minutes.
Uh-oh. Steve Wayne rappers, but I've never been edible. I'm a cracker, not a vegetable, fed to an extraterrestrial. The beat is so electrical, it'll pump your heart ventricles, but I bet you will eject it if I start getting intellectual. I am not yet credible, so until I can say I'm credible, I'll say that I'm incredible, respectable, and professional. Do you read me? Am I vegetable? It's time to get down.
Ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about keeping it gangster with a beat. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show on American Freedom Radio. Holy crap, it's the final segment already, Neil.
They just flew by. It's like time, space just kind of ceased to exist. There was a... I did want to mention, I've got a wonderful little YouTube page with about 40 videos on it. Many of them quite humorous, if I do say so myself. Just go to YouTube/Neil Slade. And there's all kinds of stuff there that you'll have fun. There's brain stuff there. There's the Urfi and the Chloe show. There's Julia Liu paintings on there. So YouTube/Neil Slade, you'll have a lot of fun looking at the YouTube page. And also, of course, brainradar.com. People can go to. There's like 2,000. I started building. Let me give you a little background. Back in.
Before you do, I was just going to define the nature of some of the stuff you do. It kind of tickles you everywhere from your cranium to your humerus.
Yes. Well, I do talk about science, the real science of brain, but you know, I'm just kind of a wild and crazy guy too. So I like to have fun, and there's music, and you know, I'm a professional musician, and you know, the books are funny, and I like to have fun as we're learning, you know, have fun, just like you said early on. I started building my website back when very few people knew about the internet, at least in my end of the neighborhood. And here in Denver, you could go to the library and they would have a bank of computers lined up for the public to use. And nobody, this was back when people would just walk past the computer terminals, clueless. If you said, have you been on the internet? People would just scratch their head and go, the inner what? So I started building my webpage back then. And so it's been 16, 17 years. And the website's grown to be about 2,000 pages at this point. So you can go to brainradar.com and listen to music and watch video and read articles and just have a lot of fun and just go explore like it's a big candy store. So just want to give that little heads up to people if they want to, you know, read and check out some of the stuff on YouTube and at the site.
Can people buy your book off brainradar.com?
They most certainly can. I'm an author of 8 books on brain and behavior science, and I've got 20 CDs, and I've made 2 feature films, one called An Amazing Brain Adventure. So just go to brainradar.com, and there's a picture of Urfi and Chloe, my dogs, and if you click on that picture, it'll take you to the Brain Book and Music Store, and there's all kinds of stuff. And there's online instant downloads. You can buy audiobooks, you can buy CDs, you can buy printed books, and I autograph every single book that comes out of my bookstore here. So I autograph it personally to everybody who does that. And of course, you can go to Amazon if you want, but I ship better and cheaper if you get it directly from my website.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, final segment. Usually I try to ask the final questions of some description of that will give you, I don't know, the deepest of the deep out of the guests. So there's one or two questions. We can answer them both. First is about self-censorship, particularly when we're on radio or any kind of recorded format. There's certain names we won't mention, certain subjects we don't broach because, well, there's politics involved. Or we feel that the audience might be, perhaps judgmental, or the host might be. So I like to give the opportunity here on this show with, I would say, judging by all the conversations that I've had with my listeners,
one of the most intelligent audiences in talk radio, so they'll understand you, and I won't judge you. Second being, if in lieu of wanting to reveal something that you wouldn't otherwise, is about your deathbed confession. What would you say about your own life on your deathbed, and what would your message be to future generations?
My deathbed confession. Well, I don't know if it would be a confession because I've already said it. And the thing that comes to my mind would be the best thing I ever did in my life was make my dog happy. And I say that in all seriousness because we tend to overlook the simple things in life and we tend to undervalue what we have. So for me, I think that kind of sums it up. The best thing I ever did in my life was to make my dog happy. And I'll stick by that. And I won't say that's the only thing that I did in my life, but you know what? I think it was Carlos Castaneda or his teacher, Don Juan Matus. He says, nothing is any more important than anything else. And I think that's really an attitude that we have to have. The guy that you're sitting next to on the bus is as important as the president of the United States. And if you live your life that way, you're going to live a good life. And the person whom you're with, that's the most important person, and that you treat a dog well. If you can live your life that way, you've lived a good life. So that's my little deathbed thing.
Well, compassion. And
Go ahead.
It's about compassion. And yeah. Remember I was saying before about the American public being very, very severely through the food supply and brainwashing and what have you, been dumbed down to a large degree. And that doesn't make me any smarter, even though I know more about the United States than a lot of Americans. And I think I don't want to be offensive when I say this, but I used to look after autistic children, and I've developed this simple methodology. When people aren't quite as maybe up with the play with you or something like that, or maybe dependent in some way, and we're all dependent on our sources of information for our inspiration, for our thoughts and the things that get us through the day to a large degree. And what I found is that all the other times that people were looking after these kids, they weren't paying attention to them. They weren't listening to them. They weren't making sure that they understood what was being said and what was being done. They didn't teach them how to tie their own shoelaces. They didn't show them through stimuli that they could understand why hitting and scratching and spitting and all of that kind of stuff is wrong. I did. I took the initiative because I saw that everybody else was failing to do what was absolutely necessary, to treat them like a human being that needs a little bit of guidance and a little bit of help. And if you're in the position to be that guide, to be that helper, you are abdicating your responsibility to greater humanity and to your own peace of mind by not doing so. And that's actually the reason why I stopped looking after these autistic boys, because as hard as I tried to help them, if I wanted to help them even more by getting their condition helped or reversed by even organizing so much as a free appointment with a herbalist friend of mine who wrote the cancer prevention handbook and knows the best specialist in the country and stuff like that and has had a lot of success in reversing autism. You think the parents would be interested? No, because they've been sent around so many specialists, so many times, who've told them it's your DNA's fault, it's nothing to do with vaccines, that's just a conspiracy theory, and it's incurable, and they bleed them dry of money, and they force, in New Zealand, they force pharmaceutical drugs on them. And I see the American public being treated in exactly the same way, not similarly, but exactly the same way, as a revenue stream. Kind of like cattle with wallets. And it's horrible. And I feel for my American brethren. And I have this air of responsibility to leap into action and say, hey, hold on a second.
These people aren't bad people. They haven't done anything wrong. Their government is what's to blame. They've been brainwashed. Let's help instead of sitting around saying, you people are idiots, you're so dumb, you'll never get... Well, they're idiots and they're dumb, some of them. In fact, one might even go so far as to say most of them. If you stop wanting to help, if you start sitting back and doing nothing, then it becomes your fault, even though it wasn't yours in the first place. Your awareness is your impetus, I feel.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, and I think people are going to get so much more out of life when they become participants at every level of their experience, and become less couch potatoes and more farmers, as it were. You know what I'm saying? Take an active role in every moment of your life, whether it be how you think about politics, how you be involved in politics, how you be involved in your taking responsibility for your own physical well-being, that's where you're going to get your satisfaction in life, not in the accumulation of this, that, or status or wealth or whatever, but that you become an active, responsible participant in your life experience. And so, yeah, you're hitting the nail right on the head here. And you know, for me, it's, you know, start with that space between your ears, brain self-control. That, for me, that's my little contribution to help people understand what that mind motor is and what its potential is. And so if I can help in that little way, then I'll feel like I've done something.
All right. Thank you, Neil Slade, for your time today. I had no idea what we were going to be talking about. I thought we would just be talking about music and an album or something. But you've actually kind of helped me put the world into a bit more perspective today. And I don't say that about everybody, bro. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. And enjoy tickling your amygdala.
All right. Well, as they say, ladies and gentlemen, enjoy what you want to enjoy. Horses for courses, whatever tickles your pickle or your amygdala, as the case may be. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.